You're listening to Market Champions, a podcast on navigating the financial markets. Here's your host, Srivasa Prakash.
This episode of Market Champions is brought to you by Simplify ETFs. For more information, visit simplify.us. No Simplify funds will be discussed during this podcast. Hey, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Market Champions. Today, I've got a very special guest. I've got Anthony Shilipati, who is the founder and CEO of Veritas Investment Research. He's also based in Toronto, just like I am. So, you know, it's awesome to get him here. So, Anthony, thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Brilliant. My pleasure to be here, Srivasen. Thank you.
Thank you. So I wanted to start off by talking a bit about your background, you know, how you got into finance, your journey, and your journey to Bay Street, pretty much. So I'd like
to say the journey is kind of a roundabout way, almost by accident. Always following my passion and always following what I love to do. Mm-hmm. And I love business. I loved analyzing business, studying business, and running my own businesses from when I was very young, delivering newspapers. And so when I started my university in business, I always wanted to be a lawyer. And that was kind of my idea. So after 2 years, you know, I got to rush because I rush everything. And I got to hurry up and get in. And I didn't do so well on my LSAT. And then so then I started studying. I did a little better, but not good enough to get into a good school after 2 years. You know how these things work. And so I said, okay, well, I kind of like this accounting thing. I actually did a course in case studies, business case studies that were in the accounting stream. And it was like, this is really interesting. These companies are playing with their numbers. I can see it. It's like, I was fascinated by it. I said, okay, so maybe I can do this in accounting. So I went through and finished the accounting. I went to work at Arthur Andersen. Maybe you heard of them. Yep. And now I was gone long before anybody could spell Enron. In 97, I stopped. But anyway, so this is now I'm working in its mid-90s at Arthur Andersen. I started and I hated it. Within 3 months, I wanted to leave because I was so bored with the no meaning of being an auditor. You know, it's really a thankless job. Anyway, so then I met a guy. His name's Al Rosen, and he was a forensic accountant at the time. And he's teaching us how to pass the CPA exam at the time. And you know, he and I hit it off. And when I finished my time at Arthur Andersen after 3 years, I started working with him, doing litigation work, expert testimony and the such. And I was teaching at York University, teaching accounting. And I'm using examples like Laidlaw, Loewen Group and the like at the time, talking about how they're cooking the books and so on. And one of our students, Michael Palmer, he's head of research at a brokerage firm at the time called First Associates, he says, listen, can you guys write about this stuff? Like, no one talks about this way in the market. No one says the four-letter word. And you know the four-letter word, what it is, right? And that's sell. And so in 99, we started, kind of on the side of our desk. We were working on big cases like Confederation Life and Jevco, some of the biggest Castor Holdings, some of the biggest cases ever in Canada related to auditor negligence. And then we started writing these reports on companies. So things like, you know, TLC, the Laser Center and the Royal Group Technologies and CallNet. And then we wrote about Nortel. And really, we built a business on the back of Nortel. People thought we were crazy because we said they didn't generate cash. They didn't trust their numbers to governance, et cetera. And then, you know, the story is long, but it ended in 2008 and Nortel went bankrupt. But, we started off then and our mission, really, we called the company Veritas and the idea was to just tell the truth. And unfortunately, people don't like hearing the truth because sometimes the truth hurts. But that's really how, from a roundabout way, I went and got onto Bay Street.
Got it. And, you know, it's also really exciting because, you know, you were pretty much a forensic accountant focused on, you know, trying to identify these frauds. And, you know, our companies are cooking their books. So, you know, in today's markets, you know, what are the most common, you know, accounting red flags, or the most common ways that companies are cooking their books or trying to elevate earnings and so on?
Well, it's always about using the balance sheet to make the earnings higher. Or if companies in today's environment where no one really cares about earnings or cash flow and they're just looking for revenue growth, then they'll find different ways to use their balance sheet to drive revenue, whether that's, you know, booking, you know, higher receivables, financing those receivables and long-term receivables, offering credit to customers, doing tricks like bill and hold, which is something that Nortel used, where you basically accept a PO, recognize revenue. You're looking for companies where the timing between revenue recognition and cash collection is widest. So the wider this spread, the more dangerous and the more a company can manipulate. So you think about tech companies where there any company using percentage of completion. You think of tech companies, you think of engineering companies, construction companies. These are the most dangerous because they have long-term contracts. You know, in a retail business, it's pretty hard. You buy an apple, you got to sell the apple or it goes bad. Yeah. Not that I couldn't tell you ways to cheat over doing that, but that's kind of the difference.
Yep. And do you have sort of any examples or any specific companies that you're watching that, you know, have been using these kind of tricks today?
Well, I would say that, you know, today's market is littered with all kinds of these high-flying tech names that have caught the excitement of the market and investors. You know, I look at it, and now, so to looking at a particular sector like the solar leasing industry that has come up with its own accounting. Because the other big issue, and this is something that we've made a lot of noise about over the last 6 years, and that's the use of non-GAAP metrics, things like EBITDA, adjusted earnings, adjusted revenue, and all kinds of different metrics are being reported. That's when it gets really dangerous. So you look at the solar leasing companies, they have their own you know, lifetime value of customers, they have their own EBITDA calculations. And they're not, meantime, cash is very tight, earnings are slim. And that's the a dangerous industry, I think, where there's a lot of, you know, fluff and long-term expectations. I think that, you know, these high-flying names like a Tesla, for example, these things, at the end of the day, you know, if you take out the government credits, it's pretty tough to find that there's any earnings there. Yeah. and or cash flows. And building a business is very difficult, as everyone's finding. So I would say, look, there's today's market is about finding pockets of situations where companies might be stretching or an industry is getting stretched. But it's largely macro, you know, because low interest rates, it's just, you know, you could say a lot of the tech names are just are overvalued and could face headwinds like a Zoom or a Peloton or something. And I think that's really what's been driving the market. So that's sort of where we're digging.
I know one person that, you know, you have and as per your webinar series was Mark Cahotas. And Mark Cahotas is sort of well known for being, you know, critical of Canadian companies. And, you know, there's in general a lot of talk about, you know, how, you know, the TSX and in general, you know, Canada has a lot of fraud and money laundering and so on. So what are your thoughts on that? What are your views? And, you know, and sort of on the other side, you know, what should regulators, especially in Canada, be doing more in this environment?
Well, I think, look, one of the big shortcomings in Canada is we don't have a national regulator, mm-hmm. securities regulator. And I think that's what one thing, there is a movement, a pace to make that happen. I think that's critical. You know, it's too desperate right now. And you could have a different level of scrutiny at the different securities regulators in each province. And companies can play to that. And that's a problem. I think that you know, definitely we need to find there's a number of different pending enforcement actions related to the cannabis industry that are ongoing, and I think that will reveal some interesting things when those things come out, and then you'll start to see that there is action being taken. But you know, unless we get government support for the national regulator and government support for dealing with the money laundering that is said to be taking place, you know, nothing's going to change. But you have to ask yourself, I mean, you're a Canadian, I'm a Canadian. If we stop foreign money from coming into Canada, that foreign money goes into real estate largely. That drives the price and value of that real estate higher. Well, if the price of one house on my street sells for more, then my house is worth more all of a sudden. Yeah. So yes, while I want to stop it because it's illegal, at the same time, I benefit from it.
Exactly.
And this is what, you know, as Canadians, we have to be careful what we wish for. We say that we don't want to have high prices, but it's sort of like, well, not my house. Like, my house is not overvalued. Those other houses are overvalued. My house is fine.
Right. And I think that's so true. And
it's crazy.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, when it comes to the U.S., you know, there's also been a lot of talk about, number one, sort of this explosion and what is, in a way, growth at a reasonable price. But that's sort of becoming growth at any price. And, you know, you're seeing companies like, say, you know, Lemonade, Inc., or the various, you know, EV companies coming into the market that don't actually have earnings or even revenues, but then they're still selling at, you know, these crazy valuations of billions of dollars. So, number one, how much of that is sort of bent on, you know, say, you know, regulators not doing the right thing, and, you know, how much of that, and do you see, you know, sort of a speculative mania or something similar to the 1990s going on right now?
There's no question that there's a speculative mania going on. You know, when you have interest rates at 10 years at 1.3, you have inflation running at 4, you have real negative interest rates. Mm-hmm. And so that throws all your CFA textbook of how you do valuations, then calculate your discount rate. In, you know, it goes like, if you're playing a pinball game, it goes tilt. I don't know what to do here. It's like, and so what's it worth? Well, it could be worth infinity because my discount rate is a negative number. Like, it's we're in a new paradigm for that. And, you know, now the regulators are in a difficult situation because they can't cut rate. They can't raise rates because there's just so much debt that they've piled on to deal with, especially with the most recent pandemic. And as a result, you know, there's all kinds of pockets of mania. Now, I'm a firm believer that markets will eventually take care of themselves. I'm a believer in markets. Even the Fed manipulating the bond market the way they are with buying, doing QE and so forth. At some point, that stops. At some point, markets will adjust and come back to fundamentals. At the end of the day, if a company doesn't generate cash, what's it worth? And you know, but in the meantime, between now and when the market comes to that realization, all kinds of things can happen to the stock. So you have to ask yourself before you invest, am I buying a stock based on fundamentals, or am I buying a stock based on momentum? And I think the biggest mistake that investors make is they misjudge, you call it a speculation, I'll just call it like a momentum, but in essence, I'm buying the stock because I want to sell it to someone else for more, not because it's going to make me a return on my investment the same way, either through dividends or growth in earnings or whatever. And so this problem is what will lead ultimately to pain. And because these rates have been so low for so long, and so much free money flowing around, you know, as you know from the interview I had with Cohodas, and, you know, Andrew left, and I even spoke to Carson Block I mean, these are, you know, higher profile short sellers. They're kind of shying away from short selling because there's just, the regulators don't like us. The and of course, money is free flowing. So that means that you know, you need higher interest rates in order to separate good companies from bad. If everybody can access money at low rates, then anything works. Mm-hmm. And then you also need, you know, you have these Reddit situations. Right. And it's not new, you know, and I don't begrudge them. Look, they're making money. They're taking advantage of a market, you know, shortcoming or a market opportunity in the way of illiquid stocks. Yes. And they're using their capital, their clout of all the people that are on Reddit mm-hmm. to move stocks. Not unlike, you know, if the three biggest pools of money in North America, you know, Fidelity and BlackRock and I don't know, T. Rowe Price got together and they wanted a stock to move higher, it'll go higher. It's no different. But that, you know, you won't hear about that. But that happens too. Now, the difference is that this has just been going on for so long. And, you know, those typically tend to be companies that are, I want to call them real companies in the sense that they are generating earnings, they are growing, things are happening. Whereas, you know, GameStop, I mean, this is no different than Blockbuster. I mean, their business model is in decline. They were, you know, verging on collapsing. But, you know, the investors found the market opportunity and drove the stock higher. That'll continue until it doesn't. And in the meantime, trying to short it is could be insanity. And trying to buy it, I think, takes the equal level of insanity. But again, I wouldn't buy things like that, so I miss opportunities. Yeah. But that the beauty of this game is there's so many moving buses all the time. Trucks, buses, cars, yeah. Different shapes of cars. I don't have to ride each one. I don't have to get in any of them. I just watch.
And when you find one you like, you just hop on.
You got it. Investing is about finding something that you understand. You know, someone once said, if I don't speak the language of the company where it's operating, why would I buy it? Like, how do I understand the culture, the language, the business practices? As you know, in many different countries, business happens differently. It's not good or bad. It just is that way. And so when you invest your capital there and you're unaware, shame on you. Now, you could make money. There's nothing, you know, and then you think you're smart. The danger in making money is you think you're smart. The danger in losing money is that you think you're stupid. But you could be just as intelligent. It's just timing.
100%. And, you know, I wanted to move on and talk a little bit about, you know, how you think about, you know, stuff on the long side. And so when it comes to, you know, your investment process or your research process, you know, how do you actually go about, you know, generating ideas? Then what happens after that? So what check boxes does a company have to, you know, check, you know, in order for you to think that it's a good investment?
So we look at five areas. We look at the accounting and disclosure. So is it transparent? Is it clear? Or is the company trying to hide something? Do they use non-GAAP metrics that other peers don't? Then we look at the cash flow sustainability. That's key. Mm-hmm. And so how do they report free cash flow if they do? Are they cooking that number? Or is the cash flow something we're looking for, a recurring sustainable cash flow? Right. And so if this is juiced by, you know, lower maintenance CapEx or, you know, a financing of payables through payables factoring, or receivables factoring. Those are different things that could juice your operating cash flow for the short term. And so we're looking for that, those sorts of things. Then we look at the business operations. What is the sort of key driver for that business? What needs to happen for them to succeed and what needs to happen for them to fail? Mm-hmm. And then we look at the corporate governance. And assess, you know, how does management get paid? How have they allocated capital in the past? Compare it to peers. And then lastly, we look at the balance sheet. What assets do they have? Are there any hidden assets that could add value? And we look at the liabilities, obviously, what's on the balance sheet and what is off the balance sheet, because companies could have obligations that are just off balance sheet, and you need to dig through the notes and really understand the business in order to get there. So we look at each of those five areas, and ultimately, we're not rocket scientists, we're forensic accountants. The difference is, a company reports results. It comes across the wire, you get the numbers, you look at them, you see, okay, revenue, margins, blah, blah, you enter it into your spreadsheet. Actually, you don't even have to type it anymore. You just download it, it's in your spreadsheet. You update your forecast, you hit enter, discount rate, you put in the number, hit enter, I got the valuation, I'm done. We say, whoa, wait a minute. Before I use these numbers, I want to understand what accounting methods, accounting policies did they use to recognize that revenue, to record those expenses? Did it change? What tax rates did they use? Did they change? All those things, because we just don't accept at face value the numbers when they come out. We scrub those before they go into our models to do our projections. Otherwise, it's garbage in, garbage out. So really, that's the areas and that's the methodology.
Yeah, and your firm is very detailed, and never literally means truth, right? And so you want to get the truth out of those numbers.
That's right.
And so one thing that you focus on, as you mentioned, is cash flow sustainability. So what is it that, what is it that makes companies cash flow sustainable? Is it, do you focus on the business model? Do you focus on management? Do you focus on, what kind of products a company has and how competitive it is, so on? So how do you think about that?
Yeah, I think you're touching on all the key points. What business are they in? Do they have intangible that allows them to sustain a higher price, to say sustain a higher market share? And if that's the case, then that becomes sort of, they have a moat, and that will allow them to generate cash, perhaps even exceeding what its levels that its peers may generate. And that's, I think, the key things to look for in companies being able to generate cash.
All right. Yeah, great touch. You also have something that you call a sell list. And your sell lists have consistently underperformed the market, which is good, because you're pointing out these companies that are that are poorer, and therefore they have to underperform the market. So when it comes to those kind of companies, do you ever think about short selling as well? And what do you think of short selling as a strategy in this environment where pretty much everything is just flying higher and higher? And Mark Cahotas has also talked a lot about this, and my mentor Mike Green has also mentioned how flows into the market just keep sending everything higher, and so short selling has just become really, really difficult to do.
Yeah. I think that, not owning a stock and shorting a stock are two separate investment decisions. And writing a report that says sell doesn't mean short. Just like writing a report that says buy doesn't mean you should run out and buy the stock. So there has to be, we will provide the recommendation, and let's just focus on the sell, because that's where you want to focus. And so if we're saying to sell it, well, then you read the report, you believe that what our analysis shows is accurate, or at least consistent with your view of the world, and then you sell your position, either in total or some proportion. When you short a stock, you're opening yourself to risk that if it goes higher, you actually lose money. Once you sell it, it's now opportunity cost. If it goes higher, well, you could have made money, but you didn't because you sold it. If it goes lower, well, if it's part of the benchmark and you're being evaluated against said benchmark, then you outperform. But you don't have actually cash chasing that movement in the stock in the same way. It's more an opportunity cost or an opportunity profit. And so that's why when you're shorting, you need to evaluate what could go wrong with the stock going higher. The company's fundamentals may be terrible. It probably has, you know, when we think of a short, we think of a bad balance sheet with a management you can't trust. So there's poor governance. There probably is a business model flaw will eventually, obviously timing is the most difficult thing, that will eventually come to the forefront. Yeah. And so when you have these characteristics, and the last one, of course, is if you have bad accounting, don't call it fraud. Fraud, you have to remember, fraud is proven in court. So we don't write about frauds. And I think much of what gets written by a number of short sellers that call companies frauds, I think it gives short sellers a bad name, because the company's just misrepresenting perhaps its results based on the facts that you've found.
Yeah.
Fraud is the intent to deceive, which must be proven in court and is very difficult to prove. You're much better saying that, you know, the company reports a dollar. By our calculations, making the following adjustments based on the facts that we have believed to be important to this fact, to this decision, lead us to believe that the earnings or the revenues or the cash flows are actually lower than what the market perceives. And so that is more likely what you're going to find. So with short selling, you got to also understand the market movements and market flows. The company's stock price could go higher even as the fundamentals weaken, leaving aside the whole Reddit. It's just because flows are in that sector.
Right.
Or, we don't like renewable stocks. We think that they're extremely highly valued. They don't generate cash. The balance sheets are bloated. And that's a long term before they're actually going to get any sort of return on that investment that they're making today. So that's a whole sector that we don't like here in Canada. But, the price could go higher because there's sentiment behind them, right? And so that's, I think, the difference between shorting something, the concept of fraud, which is important, and just saying sell a position.
That makes sense. And going back to the discussion on, there's buses on roads, and then you just pick the buses you like, and then you, do you have any way to sort of think about momentum or timing the market? You know, a lot of people say use technical analysis and other kinds of tools. Does that have a place in your process, or do you just purely focus on fundamentals and sort of buy and hold kind of?
Everything matters around the edges. The reason why we get rolled up into looking at momentum or other factors is because we want to outperform every day. You know, the market, on the investment side, we're being evaluated not just daily, but, by the minute. What happened this morning? Your fund was down. Or what happened? Your stock, your recommendation, you're wrong. The stock was down. And it's like, I don't know. Like, there was more sellers than buyers. So there was more buyers than sellers, depending. Yeah. At any moment in time, it's hard to determine what's driving a particular stock or even a particular sector. So I think, you have to be very careful getting sucked into all these momentums. And it's not something that, and technicals, I think it's something that we would use to kind of refine timing. But for us, it's really about fundamentals. If a company has a bad balance sheet, bad governance, bad business model, bad accounting, and not sustainable cash flows, at some point it's going to run into a headwind. Between now and that point, I don't know what it's going to be. Determining what the catalyst is, like, who knew that Valiant would get exposed by Hillary Clinton on during her election, when she said that this company is racing prices unrealistically, like that from out of the blue. Who knew that was going to happen? But it, we knew that they were doing that. We'd written that. But all of, and then all of a sudden, everybody starts asking questions. Nothing is a problem until it's a problem. And then when it's a problem, it's usually a big problem.
Right.
So that's the point of the things that we write about. We write about issues that right now may not seem to be material, but when they come to light, they tend to be very material. Right. So that's really key in the process. And I think you've got to be careful if you're focusing on just some type of factor, then you just need to recognize that that's what you're doing. You have to be intellectually honest with yourself and say, the only reason why I own this stock is because I'm riding the momentum. Because then if you know that, when the momentum changes, you get out. The problem is you start out by saying it's momentum. Then it works. Well, then I must be smart. It must be because I know something special. It's not that I just followed some line in the on the screen. And so then when it moves and it goes against me, you go, well, no, but I'm smart. I picked that stock. I know everything about that company. I'm going to stay in. And then you get hammered. You just have to be intellectually honest and say, I'm just running a momentum. Or I'm doing fundamentals, and therefore the day-to-day movements in the stocks are not as important to me.
Absolutely, 100%. And when it comes to selling a stock, you know, do you have to see a change in fundamentals, or you know, a change in or change in sort of the fundamental thesis of why you invested in a stock, or would you ever sell a stock really based on price? You know, the price just went way too far here. You know, I think it's a good idea to get out. So how do you think about selling the stock? Because, you know, for example, Warren Buffett, you know, he likes to say that, you know, his favorite holding period is forever. And, you know, he's had some companies that he's just held for, you know, decades and decades and decades. So how do you think about, you know, selling the stock and getting out of long positions?
Great. Look, selling is the most difficult thing.
Right.
Because it's either an admission that you're wrong, the stock's gone down, or an admission that there's nothing else left. And that means that you're giving away the opportunity that it might go higher. And that's difficult to do, right? So what you need to do is, before you buy a stock, you need to, again, back to my point, know why you're buying it. You know, we have a recommended list. Before we put the name on, we know what we think the intrinsic value is. So when it gets to said intrinsic value, unless something has changed in the company's business strategy, fundamentals, we'll typically then make a change. Now, what I look for, what is it that's going to make us make a decision? You don't just, but just because it gets, you know, to a higher valuation or to our valuation doesn't necessarily by itself mean I'm going to take it off. We'll look more to what is management saying. I find that oftentimes, looking for, okay, so the company grew its results and now has met expectations or beat expectations. And you go, wait a minute. But the only reason why they did that was because they raised prices. Wait a minute. The only reason why they met those expectations was because they made a big acquisition. Well, that means that organically they didn't grow as much, and that may not be sustainable. So it's about digging through the why that the company's fundamentals perhaps improved. Is that something that's sustainable? And if it is, and you know, the stock sells down, but you know what? The organic growth was strong. The company's just going through a growth. You know, the companies go through growth phases. Like running a business is not a straight line from the lower left to the upper right. It's, you know, we hire some people and it works and some don't work. We made an acquisition and some things worked and some things didn't. We expanded into a new business line and some things worked and some things didn't. And you see, you start going up. Investors don't like that. They like to see this. Yeah. Well, this is only in a textbook, right? Real life business does this. And so you need to separate that textbook from the real life and understand what's driving it. And then you can make a good decision to get out of a stock.
100%. You know, when it, and you know, when you also talk about sort of scrubbing the numbers, and you know, as you just mentioned, you know, how did the company actually, you know, reach, you know, its earnings goal or its earnings expectations? So, you know, recently, for example, Lyft in the last quarter supposedly beat, you know, its adjusted EBITDA estimates. But then when you actually go look at the numbers, it added back all sorts of crap, like, you know, stock-based compensation, which is about $200 million. And, you know, and that was already over EBITDA, so, you know, adding back. And, you know, Jim Chanos has talked a lot about this as well. So, you know, going to the other side of this, you know, what are the opportunities that you see today? You know, which sectors or which industries, you know, do you think, you know, do you think that, you know, overall are sort of right for, you know, at least as value investors or as fundamental-based investors are, you know, have some decent long opportunities that, you know, investors can take advantage of? And obviously, you know, this is not, you know, investment advice or financial advice. So with that, yeah.
I think there's opportunity in the energy space here in Canada, especially. Natural gas is really turning a corner. In Europe, it's at all-time highs. Here, we're just, you know, turning upward. I think that that's a trajectory that will continue. Mm-hmm. So the natural gas space, in fact, most people don't know this, but Canada produces more natural gas than they do oil. And so that's an area of opportunity. I think that, so that with natural gas and oil, you know, when we talk about ESG, and I touched on renewables, what is going to make renewables work is higher commodity prices. The only time you decide to change what fuel you use to propel yourself is when the one you're using is too expensive. Right. And that's really going to make it work. So if we're going to get, you know, the whole renewables to work right now, it can't come from government subsidies. It's got to come from market dynamics. Mm-hmm. And so if you have higher commodity prices, that'll force more investment in renewables. That'll drive the cost down of renewables, and that'll make it work. So I think that's an area. I think there's opportunities in some telecom names in Canada. You know, I look at the space. They just finished spending some money on their wireless auction. There's some acquisitions that are pending, Shaw with Rogers, Cogeco with Rogers. I think there's some things that are going to happen there, some shakeups that could be, you know, obviously good for investors when they finally close. And what I think is, you know, obviously the election's a bit of a problem, an overhang on that. I think that the pipelines, you know, there's opportunities there with the Enbridges and the TC Energy. Just moving that commodity is very important, and that'll be a big opportunity. Once we get this rail situation settled down here in Canada and CP, if it happens, but I think it's likely to happen with Kansas City Southern. If that happens, and I think it's more likely than not, that's a great opportunity for CP to build a you know, C2C and country to country all the way down north and south pipeline. I'm sorry, not pipeline, but rail line. So that'll be tremendous. And then, you know, I'm generally cautious, cautious by nature, but, you know, it's hard for us to wrap our head around companies that are trading at 50 times earnings or a few hundred times EBITDA. It gets difficult for us to fathom that, but those things will work until they don't.
Yeah. And, you know, what you mentioned at the end, you know, companies that are trading at, say, you know, well, one other thing that's actually come from excessive use of EBITDA, and, you know, Jim Chanos has talked about this, is that, you know, they've used pro forma accounting, pro forma earnings, you know, and all sorts of metrics to sort of inflate, you know, inflate expectations and inflate stock, inflate like the stock prices. So, you know, what are your views on that, and what are your views on, you know, the general accounting practices that are used today, and you know, more importantly, what would you actually change about them? If they place now Anthony Shilipati, you know, the head of the U.S. GAAP accounting, you could change any accounting rules or accounting regulation, what would you go about changing?
It's a good question. So, you know, I've been on the Canadian Accounting Standards Board. I'm an advisor to the OSC. I'm an advisor to the International Accounting Standards Board as well. So I take a very proactive role in accounting standards setting. I think it's very important. And I think the root of all evil lies in non-GAAP metrics, because the moment that you let a company report anything it wants. I always, tell the story of my, now she's 16, my youngest daughter. And if I said to her, Madeline, why don't you fill out your report card? And it's like, well, what's she going to give herself? Like 50s, 60s? Why? Of course, she's got 80s and 90s, right? If we had to mark ourselves and then we hire our friendly neighborhood auditor, and actually there's no audit, because the problem with the non-GAAP metrics is there's no standards, they're not audited, and companies can do whatever. There's no consistency. So that inherently causes a problem. Mm-hmm. Now, if I were in accounting standard setting, it's very difficult, because look, the standards have become more complex because the businesses are complex. And as business becomes more complex, you need more complex accounting standards to deal with them. I think that we've lost our way in the sense of, where we need fair value accounting. And that creates no end of problems. And then I think that we have too much, the use of stock options. I think that causes a question to what should be included in earnings. And we take the view that, options are an expense. I mean, if you're going to retain an employee, you either give them cash or you give them stock. Well, the treatment of either of those, if I give you a dollar of stock and a dollar of cash, well, I can exclude the stock option dollar, but I can't exclude the dollar of salary. So why wouldn't I just pay all my employees in options and not have any expenses? Well, obviously that doesn't make sense. So this is an area of problem. I think that, when all these new businesses related to crypto, they're kind of moving ahead of even where accounting standards are. And how do you audit the existence of said coins? Where are they? Well, we already know the story about the few hundred million that got lost and the guy's apparently dead. I mean, these kind of situations are very interesting. So how do you audit that? So I think if I were in charge, I would say companies need to make very clear how they're reporting their non-GAAP metric. There's nothing wrong with non-GAAP metrics inherently, but just show me. I got a dollar of income, and then I made this adjustment, this adjustment, this adjustment, this adjustment, and I got to $1.10. Okay, now I can argue I don't like that adjustment. That one makes sense to me. I'd actually make this other one that you didn't make, and that gets me to 96 cents. Okay, now we can talk. But when I can't understand how you got to $1.10, now we got a problem. And I think we're getting closer to that. The International Accounting Standards Board is starting to think about including non-GAAP metrics as a number on income statements, and as is the FASB. So there's movement to pace.
And Mark Cahoudas, if he was the SEC, there would be a ton of changes that would come, and there would be a lot of bad guys that would be brought ahead. And so are there any changes that you would make, if you were chair of the SEC? Because right now, Gary Gensler, he's actually starting to shake things up, unlike the previous guy. He's talked a lot about regulating, for example, crypto, and he's starting to take sort of a harder stance on financial regulation than his predecessor. So we talked about accounting, but if you're just in general, the head of the SEC, what sort of behaviors do you see that are sort of the most antithetical to good free financial markets, and what would you go about changing?
I think you have to, that the SEC has to expose stop these IPOs that are just high flyers that don't really have any kind of real business that's sustainable. And mm-hmm. So the underwriters are making a ton of money, the exchanges make a ton of money because a new listing makes a ton of money. So at some point there has to be some repercussions. Some of these businesses that have gone public and have destroyed investor capital, There needs to be, like, look at all these SPACs that have blown up, okay? There needs to be action against these SPAC issuers and those that have structured them to say, listen, this was a bad deal and you brought this to market. And how could you do that?
Right.
And what did you know when? And when, you know, what did you know and when did you know it? So I think that's an area of importance. And look, in Canada, I think that the area of that needs attention is the Mortgage Investment Corporation and all the sort of shadow lending, whether it's in the residential mortgages, commercial mortgages, and commercial finance. There's a lot of money sloshing around there in a largely unregulated or poorly regulated segment of the market. And that's an area that needs attention here in Canada.
Yep. And with that, you know, do you have any closing thoughts? I just want to wrap up the interview right there. So any closing thoughts, Anthony? I think it's been fantastic, you know, having you on.
I guess my closing thoughts would be that, you know, these markets have really shaken. I mean, you've mentioned so many. When I think of, I'm a big fan of Jeremy Grantham, and Ray Dalio, and of course Warren Buffett, and there's a lot of rhetoric running around that these individuals don't know what they're doing anymore, that they've lost it, and so that these markets will go through these type of phases where things become so displaced, and I think. You have to be careful. When you're right, you end up becoming emboldened that, as I said, it must be because you're smart. It must be because you know something. We tend to study, mistakes that we did because we don't want to repeat them. But when we're right, well, I'm just right. I'm intelligent. I got it right. But that's the one you got to study as well. Why did I get it right? Was it momentum? Was it something I saw in the business, fundamentals, et cetera? And that way you can repeat it. You know, when you look at today's market and conditions, I think, the danger of having too many degrees, because we have degrees, we can rationalize anything. We can say, it makes sense, yeah, that, a painting is worth X, but once I take a digital print of said painting, it's worth 10x. I mean, that makes sense. I can rationalize it because I'll run some type of model, whatever, and convince people that that makes sense. But to someone outside of that, that doesn't have any degrees, he'll say, well, wait a minute, that doesn't make sense. The original painting is obviously worth more than the replica. And so I'm talking about these NFTs, right? And that whole market. I think that just makes the point of how far we've come away from some common sense in the market. And I don't know when it goes away, but as long as there's government support, without end, as long as there's really low interest rates, then it's hard to separate winners from losers. But when that day comes, and eventually at some point, things will come to an end, then you're going to have to be careful about which stocks you own and which stocks you don't. You're already starting to see, the winners and losers being separated. The market's kind of been treading water here. But within that, there's some sectors that are getting hurt and others that are doing well, and individual stocks as well. So right now, I think we're getting to that point in the market, especially here heading into Q3. This is the most dangerous time. If companies don't meet or beat the Q3X estimates, and these are big estimates for them to meet, I think we could see some more volatility or question marks in the markets.
You're absolutely right. And Anthony, before I let you go, could you just give the audience, sort of a synopsis of where they can find you and sort of your work and what you're doing for Retrust?
Can you ask that question again? I'm sorry.
Sure. So before I let you go, could you sort of just give the audience sort of a quick summary of, where they can find you and your work and what you do at Veritas?
So, veritascorp.com. We're running a housing conference coming up. This is going to be our ninth annual. It's considered to be one of the most industry in Canada. We obviously write research, pension funds and mutual funds, but we do have some offerings for the individual and or smaller advisors or family offices. We're here to ensure that capital is better allocated. And that's really our mission, whether that goes through philanthropy. We've started a foundation that writes about charities as well and the industry, or whether it's in the capital markets and it's going to public companies. So that's our mission. And we're here, and we'll continue to actively ensure that the Canadian markets are a safe place to invest.
Well, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking with you, Anthony. Thank you so much for being on. And, thank you. It's awesome.
Servetan, keep it up. I'm very impressed that this is something you've taken on, and I wish you continued success.
Thank you for listening to Market Champions. To never miss an episode, make sure to subscribe, and we'll see you next time.